Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. A typical supermarket in the United States, we're talking about the big ones, carry more than 38,000 products, everything from cereal and bread to chips and crackers. Now, you'll find a number of different brands on the shelves, but those brands are predominantly owned by just 10 multinational corporations. And they have combined revenues of more than $1 billion a day, while 1 in 8 people go to bed hungry every night. Oxfam spent 18 months rating these companies, and they include Nestle, Pepsi, Kellogg's, and Coca-Cola. Oxfam recently released its Behind the Brands report, which shows that the world's Big Ten largest food companies are failing to meet ethical standards. The report scored these companies based on 7 key issues, including climate change, water, land, transparency, and women. These companies are valued at almost $7 trillion. Combined, they make $1 billion a day. Last year, Nestle, the world's largest food company, had revenues of $92 billion. That's close to the gross domestic product of Slovakia, and almost enough to put it in the top third of all nations that year. That's according to data from the International Monetary Fund. So how are these giant food companies operating, and what will it take to hold them accountable? Today, we are joined by Chris Jochnik. He's director of the private sector engagement at Oxfam America and one of the lead researchers for the new report Behind the Brands. He's also co-founder of the Center for Economic and Social Rights. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Tom Laskaway. He's co-founder and executive director of Food and Environment Reporting Network, an independent nonprofit news organization that produces investigative reporting on food, agriculture, and environmental health. Tom is also a contributing writer at Grist magazine, where he covers food politics and the environment. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. So, Chris, let's start off with you. Oxfam spent 18 months on this report. How did this idea first come about? Because, unfortunately, the business practices of these massive multinationals really don't get much attention.
Well, exactly. And that was one of the reasons that we wanted to focus some more attention on it. Oxfam has been in the business of trying to address hunger and poverty and social justice for over 50 years now, and we've looked at a number of different government policies and business practices, and the whole food system, the ag business, has an enormous, what we call a footprint, a social and environmental footprint on people living in poverty. The vast majority of people who are considered poor today are smallholder farmers. And then you have over 1 billion workers in the ag food industry. So it's an enormous employer. And it also has a tremendous impact on water and land and greenhouse gas emissions. So across the board, it's just critical to understanding poverty and to addressing poverty. And that's what really drove Oxfam to get into this particular issue. And then when we went looking for who are the key actors, we break it down between the traders, the sort of big middlemen, the food and beverage companies, which was the focus of this report, and then the retailers. And we're hoping to look at all three, but this report really targets the food and beverage companies. And these are the companies that are most well known to consumers and to the public.
And speaking of that, before we dive into the report, Tom, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this, because you throw around these names like Frosted Flakes, Betty Crocker, Ben & Jerry's, Fanta, Mazola, M&M's, I mean, tons and tons of brands. But when you dig a little deeper, they are predominantly owned by just 10 multinationals. Do you think most people know that?
No, I think that it's been the case both in kind of conventional processed foods, such as with the brands you mentioned, but also even in organic foods.
Mm.
A lot of the organic foods that appear on grocery store shelves are also owned. Many of these brands are owned by the same companies that are making some of these processed foods. So I don't think people have a handle on how few companies are actually producing the vast majority of the packaged food that they eat.
Can you elaborate on this? Because it did get some attention when we had here in California our GMO labeling law, and so many people were shocked to find that the major organizations and companies that were funding the no labeling side, along with Monsanto, owned so many of the organic companies that so many people love, and they assumed wrongly that these companies are actually independent.
Right, and I think, I mean, obviously this could be its own subject
show,
of extended debate, but, you know, the food companies are finding themselves in a very complicated situation because they want to go where the market is taking them, and there's a lot of growth in organic. They're going to buy these brands. That's what they do. I mean, the whole system that we have, and now, of course, not just in food, but in many sectors, is all about consolidation. There's just enormous advantages, and there are there's a very permissive legal environment. So you're going to consolidate. You're going to buy up these different brands. And suddenly you find that when you do something that is protecting one part of your business, you are doing something that actually is deeply offensive to a whole separate group of your customers. And I think that, you know, moving back into this topic for today, you know, these reports, I think, try to bring some transparency and bring attention to issues that people obviously doesn't typically enter their mind when they're shopping in the grocery store.
So, Chris, let's talk a little bit about how you went about getting this information, because you took a look at seven different issues, including water, land, women, farmers, but also transparency. So let's talk about that first. How did you get your hands on this information?
Well, a lot of it is in the public domain, but you have to search around for it. And so we spent many months ourselves, and we brought in some additional outside research support to look for as much as we could, any public policies that these companies have developed. And we looked at their supplier codes, because that's so critical. And we looked at the sort of public commitments they're making. And then we took all that information and went to the companies themselves and asked them if there were additional policies that we may have missed. And they provided us with as much additional information as they could. They also were interested in providing us with non-public information, and then we drew a line at that and saying, you know, we're happy to receive it, but we can't include it in the scorecard because this is really all about transparency, and we didn't want to be put in a position where we are scoring companies on policies that are not public. So we really focused on what's in the public domain. Some of it for the 9 of the 10 companies are public companies, so some of it is just taken from their public filings, which they have to do, to their shareholders in any case. But much of it is just out there in different nooks and crannies on the web or what we could get our hands on from the companies themselves.
And so how did you come up with these seven different subjects? Climate change, water, land, transparency, water. How did you come up with those?
Well, again, our mission is the human side of sustainability. And so we were really looking for what impacts the most people around the world among those people living in poverty. And these were the seven issues that really get to those critical parts, these are the critical issues for people living in poverty. It's all focused also on the supply chain. So what we didn't look at some of the issues that other groups are focusing on, like obesity, for example, which is not just a problem for the U.S. or Europe, but is also increasingly a problem for developing countries, or diabetes, or all the sort of nutritional aspects. We left those to other groups that are more expert. We were really looking at the supply side, where you have, you know, hundreds of millions of people being impacted by these company supply chains, and where there is almost no transparency at all, very little information about what's going on there. And so this was really an effort to try to bring some of that information to the fore in a way that consumers and others could use as they make their buying decisions.
So again, I'm looking at your Select a Brand page. It says, who owns the brands you love and how have they scored? You've got Lay's, Häagen-Dazs, Snickers, Kit Kat, Evian Water, Sprite, Lipton, Dasani Water, Toblerone, Pepsi, Cadbury. I mean, probably name it, and it's in here, right?
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, I think people would be very surprised by how many of their favorite brands are, in fact, owned by these 10 companies, in many cases with no information about that on the label. And, we've recently seen cherished companies like Ben & Jerry's or Odwalla or other companies that are known for being either environmentally or socially progressive being bought up by these major multinationals.
So why don't we talk about Ben & Jerry's? Because that's one that I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with. They are now owned by Unilever. Is that how you say it?
Yeah,
Unilever. Okay, so Unilever, they got a score of 49% for a total of 34 over 70. So tell us, what did you learn about Unilever's business practices?
Well, in fact, Unilever is one of the better companies out there. Unilever has made many commitments to sourcing sustainably, to improving its labor practices, and it happens to be a company that we know very well, Oxfam, as we've done other reports looking at Unilever's supply chain. And so Unilever purchased Ben & Jerry's and has purchased a number of other companies and said that they were not going to undercut, you know, the commitments to sustainability of Ben & Jerry's. And to their credit, I think they have largely left those commitments in place and have been trying to improve their own record on some of these issues. That said, as you can see from these scores, they're at 50%, so that would be considered a failing grade. And that has to do with the fact that while they've made public commitments on a number of issues, on some issues like women or land, they haven't done nearly enough. And on other issues, they have not taken the next step of ensuring that their commitments are translated into concrete policies for their suppliers, and that's really where we see the greatest impact. It's one thing to have a commitment at headquarter level; it's quite another to insist that your suppliers follow those sort of commitments and ensure that it really has an impact on the ground.
So again, we're talking about Unilever. They own Lipton, Hellmann's, SlimFast, Ben & Jerry's, so many other companies. And this one stood out for me because they got a very bad score on women. They got just a 2. What does that mean exactly?
Well, we had anywhere from 30 to 40 criteria or questions for each one of these 7 themes, 276 questions in total. And we looked at every company against those 276 questions. So, well, we broke it down within each theme. So on women, we first want to know, do companies recognize the fact that women tend to be discriminated against in their supply chains? Do they appreciate the fact that women are often unable to own the land, that they are exploited in the workforce? So we want to know, have they recognized it publicly? Then we want to know, have they made any commitments to that, to those issues, to addressing those issues? Have they then taken the next step of actually doing the due diligence to see whether or not women are being discriminated against or suffering disproportionately in the supply chain? And then are they developing concrete policies and practices on the ground that would address some of those issues? So with a 2 out of 10, that reflects that a company might have made some sort of vague allusions to the situation of women, might have made a commitment to addressing some of these issues in their supply chain, but really haven't gone much further than that.
Well, most of these companies did really bad on women. So you've got Mars has just 1. They own Uncle Ben's, Snickers, Galaxy, M&M. Then you've got Danone. They own Danone, Evian, a couple other water bottled companies. They just got a 1 on women. Associated British Foods, Mazola, Twinings, they got a 1. I mean, this looks really bad. The only company, in fact, the highest score in here is 5, Coca-Cola. Sprite, Dasani, Fanta, Minute Maid, they got a 5 on women. But no one got over a 5, none of the companies, I should say.
Right. Well, what this reflects is that, and it's paradoxical because these companies are often very public about their commitments to women, and they often advertise using women and target their products to women. So, for example, we're looking right now at the questions of cocoa and chocolate, and women suffer very disproportionately the impacts on across all these issues on water, land. In many countries, women can't own land. Women farmers don't get any of the benefits of ag extension. They're not members of co-ops. They're paid poorly. So that women across these supply chains are treated very badly. And then you have these companies that are making all kinds of commitments and noise about women rights, but really just focus on their own headquarters and have completely neglected the issue in their supply chain. And so that's why you see such low scores, because companies really are not doing much of anything to address this scandal across their supply chains.
And that is Chris Jochnik, Director of Private Sector Engagement at Oxfam America and one of the lead researchers for the report that we're talking about, Behind the Brands. They took a look at the large 10 multinational food companies that own so many of the brands that line the shelves of supermarkets, 38,000 products in the average supermarket. And we're talking today about how these corporations scored on this card. They looked at everything from climate change, water, land, transparency, women, and as we were just saying, not one company scored above 6. Coca-Cola scored 5. Most of them actually scored 1. We're also joined by Tom Laskaway, co-founder and executive director of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. He's also a contributing writer at Grist Magazine. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about this report? And I'm sure that many of you probably buy the brands that we mentioned today, and we'll mention more as the show goes on. What questions do you have about the companies that you interact with on a regular basis? And do you know the business practices behind these companies? This, unfortunately, just doesn't get that much attention. And what do you think it will take to change the way these multinationals do business? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So, Tom, sticking with the issue of women, you know, Chris made a good point and said that these companies often put out these ads with women in the ads. You've got women executives at these companies, and they're often praised by feminist groups. But you don't really hear about how women are treated on the ground. Why is that?
Well, I mean, I think that the fact is these companies want to project positive images in their advertising, and they and the marketing firms and advertising firms behind these efforts, they know who their audience is. If we're talking about a domestic audience in the U.S. and who they need to advertise to, but in these enormous corporations that are sourcing globally, there can be no connection between what's going on in that sort of consumer-facing effort and what's going on the back end, where they're actually on the ground in these countries, you know, purchasing their raw materials and so forth. So, it's hard to get, I think, your head around how enormous these organizations are, and how they could perceive internally that there's no connection between what they're broadcasting out into the world and what they're doing when they're actually trying to build, create their product. And part of that is because of a lack of transparency. I mean, you hear this a lot in food production, even among farmers, when we're just talking about, for example, meat production in the U.S. You know, you hear a lot of, you don't want to know. You, the consumer, you trust us. You don't want to know what really goes on in there. We're protecting you from that. And I think there's a little bit of a perception of that, and so you get this disconnect. What you see in the treatment of women in these specifically in the in these kind of enormous supply chains for these multinationals, it's a reflection of the larger values that that society seems to express. I don't think it's certainly specific to food companies. I think you're going to see this across any of these multinationals. And I think it's something that a lot of people don't focus on, just generally speaking, because they think of a brand, they think of it's an American brand, they think that they're buying an American product. And in many cases, it is something that's produced in the U.S. In many cases, it's something that's manufactured in the U.S. with raw materials that have been sourced globally. And I think that that's something in particular that one loses sight of, and that some a tool like this, a report, but also the website that Oxfam's put together, I think it connects those dots in a way that most people simply would never have on their own.
Well, let's hear from a few callers on this. Let's go to Jason in Salinas. Hi, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So what I'm curious about is if there has been any attempt through the courts to try to hold American companies that they consider their base here, they file their taxes here, to uphold the same sort of labor laws for existence that we have in the States and not skirting around it by going elsewhere? Has anybody tried to actually legally challenge any of these practices?
Tom or Chris, do you know?
Sure. I mean, so
Chris.
The kind of things that you see on the legal front would be something like putting in environmental and labor standards into free trade agreements. And that way there becomes this legal framework for going after companies for violating these practices internationally. But by and large, if these things take place in other countries, American law doesn't extend there. There are a few things like corruption. So there are bribery laws that make it illegal for you to bribe foreign officials in foreign countries. And this is for U.S. corporations or corporations doing business in the U.S. And you saw the Walmart scandal recently. What typically would happen with international labor and environmental violations is that they make them public relations campaigns because this is not something that these corporations want to have in the top of mind among their consumers, and so they tend to react after the fact. But as far as legal action, it's very difficult because there's no standing to sue someone on acts committed in foreign countries.
So then what can be done about their business practices?
Gee, if I knew that. No, I think these kinds of reports, I mean, Chris can speak to this, but you do have to reveal what's actually going on. You have to make this matter to consumers, but it does show the limits of voluntary action and these kind of commitments. There are also shareholder actions that can be effective against these corporations, although that itself, those are also quite difficult. You still have, these companies are still, many of them are still operating in the U.S., and you can certainly restrain what they do within the U.S. through law and through legal reforms. But even that, if you think about what's going on in the sort of the real domestic food industry, again, meat production and agriculture, it's very hard to create real reforms that create accountability, even for existing environmental laws like the Clean Water Act. Agriculture is very often exempted from many provisions of the Clean Water Act. It's a tall order just because of the influence that these corporations have throughout the political process, and that's why public relations campaigns and I think now in social media is one of the most effective ways of reaching these companies because they do care about that.
And what would you add to that, Chris, before we go to break?
Well, I would just say I would agree with that. It's very tough on the legal front, although there is at the extremes one legal statute that allows you to raise human rights issues in the U.S. If there have been if you can directly tie them to companies. That's called the Alien Law, Alien Tort Claims Act. It's a statute that is even as difficult as it is to raise those kinds of claims, it is even now being threatened by companies who've raised whether or not that is even applicable to them, and it's in front of the Supreme Court right now. So on legal fronts, yes, very tough. On the other hand, there are other ways, and as Tom suggests, I think the reputation of these companies, especially the ones that are consumer-facing, like the 10 that we've put on our scorecard here, the reputation is often their top and most prized assets. The Coca-Cola brand is worth something like somewhere between $60 and $80 billion or so, and that asset, that reputation of the company, is very easily tainted by scandals in the field or by organized consumer campaigns or by other actions aimed at raising awareness about different issues. And so while we would not encourage people to do that maliciously or irresponsibly, there are ways of putting pressure on these companies that can be quite effective on the one hand here in the U.S. The other thing I would say, though, is that long term, these are not problems that are going to be solved by U.S. consumers or by U.S. companies. These are problems that have to be solved by the constituencies, the farmers, the consumers, the public, and the governments in those developing countries. And so
And hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break. What do you think is the most effective way to put pressure on these multinational food corporations? You're listening to Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call, a show that depends and relies on engaged listeners. You can join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can post a comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you'll also find links related to today's show. And that's also where you can sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter. Just click the email newsletter link on the right side of the page at yourcallradio.org. yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation about what data brokers know about us. How do you protect your personal information from the companies making tens of millions of dollars by gathering and selling our information to marketing firms? And how concerned are you about what companies know in this digital age? That's tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about a new report from Oxfam. They spent 18 months rating the world's largest multinational food companies. We're talking about companies like Nestle, Pepsi, Kellogg's, and Coca-Cola. Now, these 10 companies own just about everything in the supermarket, 38,000 products, cereal, bread, chips, crackers, and the brands that we're naming. I'm sure a lot of you probably eat this food. And so what questions do you have? And do you care about the business practices, everything from labor, land, water to women? We just got an email from Chris in Oakland who says, your question, how many consumers actually know how multinational companies operate, should be how many people actually care about how multinational food companies operate. We have to understand that many people outside of your listener base and outside of the conscientious consumer base probably doesn't care about this. Cheap food and recognizable brands appeal to them, and that's what they care about. So what are your thoughts on that? We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And what will it take to actually pressure these multinationals? None of them scored over 5 when it comes to women's rights. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Tom Laskaway is co-founder and executive director of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. He's also contributing writer at Grist, where he covers food politics and the environment. Chris Jochnik is director of private sector engagement at Oxfam and one of the lead researchers for this new report, Behind the Brands. So, Chris, what did you think about Chris's email, that the real question should be how many of you actually care about how multinational food companies operate?
Well, that's a really important question. And what I think most of the research on this shows is that people do care, but they don't care as much as other issues like price and quality or flavor. And so if we can find a way to get people first the sort of information that they care about and then make it easy for them to make informed decisions, small numbers of consumers can still have a large impact on these companies. So we don't need to have 80% of consumers buying sustainably to influence companies. It's enough if, you know, 10 or 15% of people actually start pausing in front of products and thinking about some of these issues. That is certainly enough to make companies very nervous and to have them start changing their behavior.
Well, you have a very easy way to share this information on Twitter and Facebook. What sort of reaction have you received from this report?
This has been one of our most popular reports. We've gotten something like 80,000 people that have already taken action around the world. Most of that action is letters or emails aimed at the companies. We've also noticed a big uptick in the amount of time people are spending on the website because it's an engaging website. It's made to be very interactive so that people can stay on it and look at different brands and see what the scores are. So, and we think we've had very good pickup from the public. We've also had good pickup from investors who are concerned about these issues and that we consider to be a key constituency in terms of putting pressure on companies. And the companies themselves, all 10 companies have reached out and have engaged with us around the scorecard, and we think that we're going to see movement from the companies in fairly short order. So far, we're optimistic about it.
And Tom, what's interesting is, you know, here in the Bay Area, there's just a lot of local food activism and Northern California in general. What are your thoughts about bringing this issue into the local food issue? Because I bet you, and I'm, you know, this is a class issue, really. I know a lot of people in the local food and activism movement would look at this list and say, I don't eat any of those brands.
That's true. I think, well, that may be true, but I think that these categories that Oxfam picked are, you know, incredibly relevant to food production generally. You know, one of the criticisms of organic food and organic standards, certainly as you're seeing it now with the kind of larger scale organic production, is this question of workers' rights. And are workers' rights still, are they a fundamental enough part of the organic growing or organic growing techniques? And so I think that if you went and you looked at California growers and food producers and kind of rated them along these categories, you might also be surprised, just because this stuff is hard. And I think it, as important as looking at the brands that many consumers are buying, these major brands, it's looking at these categories and linking them to food and food production, because this stuff does sometimes get lost. There's a lot of talk about environmental impacts of food production, but these are these very specific categories, and of course the workers feature so much more prominently here than is often done in some of these in the context of food production. And I also think, especially in California, I think there are many people who use these kinds of scorecards to do all sorts of shopping, whether it's seafood guides, you know, to sustainable seafoods, or the environmental or the toxic chemical guides telling you about the products and the chemicals in your products. And so this is another kind of layer on top of that. And it's on the one hand incredibly helpful. It's also a lot to ask of consumers. And I think what's important in terms of putting together all of these different guides, when they walk into a supermarket trying to understand the impact of what they're buying, it can be overwhelming. And I think one of the things that I like about what Oxfam is doing is not just giving you the scorecard, but then giving you a platform, certainly in some cases, a platform to provide feedback to the companies. Because I think that people aren't necessarily don't like to be told what to buy. You know, you can't buy that because that's, you know, they don't practice good, you know, their corporate practices are terrible. But if you say, here's a brand that you like and we know you care about because you buy it, and people's relationships to brands can be very emotional, well, here's how you can help them do their job better or do things better, I think you're going to find a lot of support for that from consumers.
And again, we're speaking with Tom Laskaway. He's a contributing writer at Grist Magazine and executive director of Food and Environment Reporting Network. Chris Jochnik is one of the lead researchers of Oxfam's new report, Behind the Brands. And let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you very much. It's a great show.
Thank you.
I'd like to hear from the guests about how much information the companies they interviewed were willing to give out about genetically modified aspects of their foods. And I also, as somebody who doesn't really understand all of the ramifications of that issue, wonder if they actually have publications on their stand or position on it. And I'll take it off the air if you want, or stay on.
Okay, you can stay on in case you have another question. Chris, do you want to take that?
Sure, but it'll be unsatisfactory because we didn't look at the question of GMOs in this particular report, and it's not been an issue that we've spent very much time with at Oxfam, although I know it's a critical issue and it's a real flashpoint for many people. But the issues that we looked at had more to do with how farmers and women and workers were treated in the supply chains, and we didn't get into the GMO question, so I can't really comment specifically on that.
Tom, do you want to speak generally about that, just because a lot of people are concerned about GMOs?
Yeah, I mean, what I can say is that about 90%, it varies from crop to crop, but 80 to 90% globally of corn and soy in particular are genetically modified, and they're the two kinds of genetic modifications. A lot of people think that there are more kinds of things that the seed companies can do, but the two main forms of genetically modified foods are ones that, when they grow, they produce their own pesticide, and others that are tolerant to particular pesticides, and it's specific to these grains, and then also soy. So if you've got a processed food that has a corn-derived product or soy-derived product that is not organic, it is odds are overwhelmingly in favor of the fact that they contain genetically modified ingredients. There are a few fruits that are out there. I think there's a genetically modified papaya that was modified to resist a disease, particular disease. But really, it's these grains and soy. And yes, it's going to be in any processed food just about that doesn't have an organic label or say that it's GMO-free.
And even according to the Grocery Manufacturers Association, GMOs are now present in about 75% to 80% of the processed food in all supermarkets. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really high.
It is, although it's not to downplay it at all, but much of that would come from a derivative, like a corn derivative, you know, like maltodextrin, a sweetener or something, that is added into the product that doesn't actually have corn in it as a main ingredient. So you get a lot of these chemicals that are derived from corn and soy that are then put into these products. You know, again, when you read that label with the sort of, you know, multisyllabic odd, you know, chemicals, many of those are derived from corn and soy, and if they're genetically modified corn and soy, then that qualifies as a genetically modified ingredient.
All right. Well, thank you for the call, Robert. And we're in the future, we're either going to do a show about Monsanto or talk about media coverage of the amendment that was included in the budget bill. So thanks for calling in. Let's go next to Bruce in Broondale. Hi, Bruce. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning. One of the comments earlier about the impact of people on the food companies that actually have, I think, doesn't appreciate fully that if you take a food company and you hit their sales by 20%, you're likely to hit their profit margins by more like 80% because they have a lot of fixed costs in keeping this product in the pipeline. So it takes a very small change in actually the amount of sales decline. If, for instance, women said, geez, Kellogg's is unfair to women, I'll buy Post instead, they could have a huge impact. And supermarkets respond very quickly when they see how many inches of shelf space they should give one box of cereal versus another. And that shift, again, is sort of tectonic because once you're out of that shelf space, it's very hard to get back into it.
Well, yeah, I mean, Chris, he makes a great point because when the bottom line is affected, the company has no choice but to act, right?
Yes, and we've been happily surprised by how quickly the companies responded to this report and to some of the advocacy, the public advocacy that we did. So, for example, with on cocoa and women specifically, where we took out some ads and talked a little bit more publicly about how women are treated in the supply chains of these major cocoa buying companies, Nestle, Mars, and Mondelez, all three of them were very quick to respond and have been quite good about making commitments to addressing some of the issues around women that we raised. So, and we've seen that in other industries as well, where companies are consumer-facing, where they face consumers that do have access to information that are concerned about these issues, they are quite quick to respond when they think that their reputation may be impacted. And I think that offers us a lot of hope that we can actually address some of these issues, especially today when it's so much easier to communicate through social media and so forth.
Are you planning to do any follow-ups to ensure that these companies act on their promises?
Yes, for sure. We're in for the long term, and we have offices and people in 90 countries around the world, Oxfam does, and so we will definitely be following up on any commitments the companies make.
And, you know, Tom, these companies are major advertisers for the media. How do you think that affects the reporting on these business practices?
Well, you know, I would say you're not going to see news organizations shying away from doing stories. They're going to do stories that they think people care about. I don't think you're going to see a lot of people saying, well, we can't do a story like this because these guys are big advertisers. I mean, a news organization would, of course, swear up and down that they don't. But I think I will tell you that, you know, my perspective, kind of switching hats and talking about things from my perspective as someone who's involved with a news organization, international stories can be very hard sells in you know the news marketplace. They're just not considered as you know as hot a story by a lot of people. Now that may be incorrect. It may be editors sort of showing their own prejudices, but the big complicated stories that are talking about international impacts typically are not can be difficult to sell on the one hand. On the other hand, a huge scandal involving a corporate, global corporate brand can be very juicy stories. So I don't see that the advertising angle is an issue. I mean, you did see some advertising about some food-related advertising battles during the Super Bowl, but that was a network which was known for picking and choosing ads, telling someone who was advertising against Coke that they didn't want them to run that ad. But that's completely separate from news organizations kind of making editorial decisions based on that.
What are your thoughts on that, Chris? I mean, how have the corporate media outlets in the U.S. responded? Because when we were doing some research, The Guardian covered this extensively. But what about U.S. media outlets?
Well, I think the U.S. media is a tougher sell generally, just because you're up against so many other stories and interests than in the U.K. with The Guardian. So we have not seen the same coverage that other countries have seen with the media. I don't know that we would attribute that to the media companies being cowed by their advertisers. I can't really speak to that. But we're not letting it stop us because so much of this message can get out through other sources, and that increasingly we don't need to rely on the mainstream media. So we have seen good pickup with radio stations like yours and some of the more progressive media outlets, and we hope to be able to break through to some of the mainstream ones as well eventually.
What about lobbying? Did you look at that and just how much lobbying influences legislation on these issues?
We did not look at specific lobbying practices. What we did look at is we included the question of whether the companies are being transparent about lobbying, so whether they are publishing how much money they're putting towards lobbying and what positions and through which business groups and so forth. That is an issue on the scorecard that goes into the whole question of transparency. And we know that these companies devote enormous amounts of resources to lobbying, and that is really a critical issue and not an issue that has been nearly sufficiently addressed by advocates and by investors. So we hope that going forward, more investors and more consumers and more NGOs will focus on that critical issue of political influence.
And on the issue of transparency, you gave Nestle a 7 score. You said pretty impressive. Nestle reveals where its sources come from and how much it sources. Shame its supplier data is lacking. Nestle makes a Nescafe, Nesquik, and Smarties, for example. And then you've got Dannon behind Evian Water. They got a 6. Coca-Cola got a 5. Mars got a 5. Unilever, again, owner of Ben & Jerry's, and Lipton got a 5. Kellogg's down at 4, and then at the very bottom, you've got General Mills, Betty Crocker, Haagen-Dazs, Cheerios. They scored a measly 2 on transparency.
Yes, that's right. Some of these companies do a very good job, or I shouldn't say very good, but they do a much better job than others at transparency and at disclosure generally. Some companies can be quite good on one or two issues. Few are good across the board. And as I was saying in an earlier question, transparency is really critical. It's not only critical so that investors and consumers can get a sense of what's going on in these companies, but it's also one of the most critical issues to trying to address these kinds of issues in country. And so that local activists and advocates and local governments are also in many ways impacted by the lack of transparency, and they have no idea which companies are involved with which suppliers and which farms and or what the conditions are, so that if we really want to solve these problems long term, we need to provide that information not only to the consumers in the West, but also to help shine that light for local advocates in country who can then do the same kind of engagement at the local level.
And that is Chris Jochnik. He is one of the lead researchers for the new Oxfam report Behind the Brands. And you can find this report. It's done very well with really good graphics. It's easy to share. It's easy to read at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Tom Laskaway. He's contributing writer at Grist and executive director of the Food and Environment Reporting Network. And we have just about 7 minutes. So if you'd like to jump in on this conversation, if you have any questions about brands, do you know the business practices behind the companies that make the food you eat. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. A couple of emails. Aaron in San Francisco says, I think most of America cares primarily about price, so we have to lower the price of local fruits and veggies and or stop subsidizing corn. Maybe food awareness can be broadcasted using TV ads during American Idol Wife Swap or one of the millions of other terrible shows that I and much of America watches, she says. And then she goes on to say, I'm a strong proponent of eating whole foods because you just don't know what goes into your food. Thank you. Yes, Aaron, thanks for writing in. And Catherine writes, some retailers such as Trader Joe's or store brands at large chains sell products under their own label, which are manufactured by other companies. Please let us know, how can we find out who actually makes or processes any particular item? I've asked store employees at times, but usually they don't know, or they say it's company policy not to discuss that. Tom, how should we deal with this?
You know, the store brand issue is an interesting one, and I don't know if Chris Oxfam is going to look at this as part of if they do a report on retailers. But for many brands, store brands, they're actually and often manufactured in the same facilities that manufacture for the for more familiar brands. So often there's actually not a huge distinction between the actual products itself. It's simply the label. But it can be very difficult. I mean, you know, the whole point of a store brand is it's sort of a non-brand. It's just the thing itself, and you're buying it because it's got the retailer's name on it, and it's typically cheaper. But you have even less transparency there. I mean, there's some exceptions. I think Whole Foods tries to be more transparent about their own brands, but that is a big challenge.
And Chris, do you have any quick tips on that one?
I think it's very hard with the store employees. Unfortunately, that's right. And where we really need to start pushing this issue, I think, is from the top, from these large buyers of the commodities. And so that's why we look at the food and beverage industry. These large brands, they're the ones that can really impose policies that will eventually lead to greater transparency. As it stands, what we were somewhat shocked by is how little knowledge even the companies themselves have about their supply chains, and so they are also largely in the dark on a lot of these issues. And we're asking them at a minimum, those companies have to know where their commodities are coming from, and they have to disclose that. And then we can work down the chain and try to push others, the middlemen and the traders and so forth, to also be more transparent and sustainable. But at this stage, it's just a black box. And so really that's why you see such poor performance in our scorecard. Companies are not even aware or beginning to put pressure on others to start that sort of due diligence and reporting process. And so we really are at something of a starting point on many of these issues, which is crazy.
And then also, according to your scorecard, Kellogg's got a 2. They show zero knowledge of workers in their supply chain. So Kellogg seems to be at the bottom of a lot of these scores.
Yeah, they just have not put the same efforts into making sure that their sustainability commitments, to the extent that they have them, are translated into policies in the field. And they're not nearly as open as some of these other companies are about some of these issues. So they are a poor performer on at least the issues that we looked at.
And we're talking Pringles, Pop-Tarts, Special K, Corn Flakes. Thank you again for the email, Catherine. We've got another email from Jamie, who wanted to let people know about California's Assembly Bill 343. This is what he says is a trend of states introducing the ALEC gag bills, sponsored by the American Legislative Exchange Council, that basically criminalize people who photograph or document activities in slaughterhouses and major animal abuse. And this bill is going to be heard April 17th, AB 343, by Assemblymember Jim Patterson, and it'll prevent filming animal cruelty. So thank you for that, Jamie. Did you specifically look at anything like this about how animals are treated, Chris?
No, we didn't. I mean, I find that also shocking, and I'm glad someone raised it. But
yeah.
No, we were really looking at the human impact.
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised that something like this is introduced in California. But yeah, I was going to add this to my story list. So thank you for emailing this, Jamie. We'll put an info on the website. I think we have time for one caller. So let's hear from Christopher in San Francisco. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I'm a local journalist and writer on food issues, and it sounds like a great report. The one thing I wanted to raise is there's a lot of focus on consumer action and not much focus on government action and government regulation.
Yes.
And so the previous email kind of goes to that point. I wonder if I could talk briefly about the role that the state can play.
Yeah, I'm so glad. And this is Christopher Cook. He's author of Diet for a Dead Planet. Thank you so much for calling. I'm so glad you raised this because we did a whole show about this, talking about the plastics industry. What are your thoughts on that, Chris? There's so much focus on, you know, individual power and consumer power and so little focus these days on corporations.
I have to apologize because I actually missed much of the question from the caller.
So it's basically, why isn't there more pressure put on the corporations? The onus is usually on us. It's like, you've got the power to change things. You've got the power to, you know, take a cloth bag to the grocery store, which is great. But what about putting the onus on the corporation?
Right. Thanks. I think that's a really important point. And again, it's why we in this report are focusing on these large brands. Many of the companies will say, we just, you know, we're one small purchaser from a large conglomerate or from a middleman, and we don't have the influence. And what we find is that where companies really are scandalized about particular issues, let's say it's an environmental scandal or a child labor scandal, they can fix these problems because it's not just their economic power. It's also their political influence, their social influence, their relationships. They're often very tight with the governments in the countries where they operate. They have enormous brand influence. And so these companies are powerful way beyond what might be projected by just their revenues, which are already enormous, or by their particular market share. Certainly the large brands that we're focused on. And so I think the caller is exactly right. We need to push companies to deploy not just their economic leverage, but their other forms of influence, and to be transparent about it, not just for their narrow commercial interests, but for their sustainability commitments.
That's Chris Jochnik. He is one of the lead researchers for Oxfam's report Behind the Brands. Tom Laskaway is executive director of the Food and Environment Reporting Network and contributing writer at Grist. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
And thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us. Find information about this report, yourcallradio.org. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. What do data brokers know about you? On the next Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by looking at the companies that are making millions of dollars by gathering and selling our personal information to marketing firms. Who are these data brokers, and how do they get their hands on our information? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. How do you protect your personal information, and how concerned are you about what companies know? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on, and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up next from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. On Friday, April the 12th, we invite you to come check out Heard Here, extraordinary stories of ordinary people live on stage at the Victoria Theatre at 8 p.m., You'll see legendary radio duo The Kitchen Sisters alongside KALW's Martina Castro and Hannah Baba. Also, writer Chris Collin will be there, and they'll all be sharing stories of ordinary Bay Area folks facing extraordinary challenges. It's free, 8 o'clock, Friday, April 12th, at the Victoria Theater in the Mission District here in San Francisco. Everything you need to know, information, etc., on our website, KALW. It's 11 o'clock. This is KALW San Francisco Local Public Radio.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say, and you're talking about the death of a political icon.
We've lost a great Prime Minister, a great leader, a great Britain. As our first woman Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher succeeded against all the odds.
She was the first woman to lead a major Western democracy, spending 11 years as leader and winning three successive general elections. Margaret Thatcher has died at the age of 87. She was a divisive figure who stood her ground and shaped the political landscape for future generations. At home, her policies led to social unrest, mass unemployment, and the promotion of a free market economy. On the world stage, she joined forces with President Reagan, supported reform in the USSR, and fought a war against Argentina over the Falkland Islands. We're live hearing what you made of the Iron Lady.